Okay, I think we're all settled in, so we'll get started. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to one of the last sessions of this amazing long week. This is the Men Engage session, and I do thank you for staying when others are off to drink margaritas and enjoy. You are showing your commitment to the issue of gender equality by coming here, and so we appreciate that. In return for that, we promise to give you a very exciting and engaging, no pun intended, session around work with men and boys, and an opportunity to have a real dialogue about this issue, and hopefully to do some networking. My name is Andrew Levac. I am the co-chair of the Men Engage Alliance, a global alliance working with boys and men for gender equality. I am also the director of the Engender Health Men as Partners program based in New York City. I'm going to be chairing this session, and I'll start with a little bit of an overview of Men Engage. But before I do that, just want to give you an overview of what this session is about. Like I said, it is a bit different and designed in mind with the fact that it is the end of the last day. I'm going to start with an overview of this Men Engage network, give you an idea of a sense of what its guidelines and beliefs are and what it is committed to doing and some of its work. And then after that, we're going to give a chance to get a sense of what this field is about by having a very distinguished panel of three gender activists and an interviewer, Benno de Kaiser, who will be having an opportunity for a dialogue with them to share about how this work intersects their personal lives and their professional lives. And then after that, we'll have comments from our moderator, Jerker Edstrom, who will talk a little bit about moving beyond the personal to the political in terms of work with men and boys around masculinity issues. And finally, we will ask Gary Barker to share some updates around what the Men Engage Alliance has been doing, ways to get involved with the alliance, some updates on a global symposium that will be occurring in March 2009. And then the last 30 minutes of the day will be an opportunity for some informal networking, for people to talk about what is happening in different regional networks. So that will be an opportunity for a bit of milling around. And so no more PowerPoint presentations at that point. So let me start by telling you a little bit about Men Engage. Let's see. Where would be...
No, it's not that one.
It's this one, right? Yeah. But this is not my slides. Could I have the next slide, please? Thank you. So Men Engage is a global alliance, and it was born out of a number of organizations coming together with a real recognition of the fact that there was a real need for a movement around the ways to engage men and boys. But there was a growing evidence base of a growing number of program examples of promising work with men and boys. But they were, wow, yay condoms. But that these programs are often rather boutique programs, that they were rather short-term, project-oriented, and that a lot of the work still hadn't gone to scale and still hadn't really engaged in major policy initiatives and really in terms of scale at the public sector. And that a recognition that all these organizations that were doing this important work could have a much more powerful impact by really sharing joint efforts together and creating a global movement. Next slide, please. So then the goal of Men Engage is to build a global network of organizations and institutions with increased commitment and capacity to implement and document effective interventions with boys and men and to take that issue into the public sector. And that work should be done in collaboration with existing efforts to promote the rights of women and girls. Next slide, please. So a long list of international partners. I won't mention all of the ones listed on there, but you'll see a range of local NGOs, international NGOs, UN organizations, all working internationally. In addition to this, there are a range of regional and country networks in Africa, Latin America, Asia, that also are part of the Men Engage Alliance, which brings a number of over 400 organizations who have been involved in the alliance. Next slide. So a little bit about what Men Engage believes in. First of all, the Alliance is dedicated to engaging men and boys to end violence against women and questioning or challenging violent versions of manhood. We're also dedicated to promoting more equitable participation by men and boys in caregiving, the care of children, and domestic tasks. We're also dedicated to working as allies with women and women's rights organizations to achieve equality for women and girls, and dedicated to promoting cultures of masculinities that respect sexual diversity and sexual and reproductive rights of all. And finally, we're dedicated to helping carry out and implement the various mandates of UN platforms of action, including the ICPD, CEDAW, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the Commission on the Status of Women's Statements, particularly ones from the 48th session, which explicitly call for a need to engage men and boys more proactively around the issue of gender equality and women's rights. So those are some core things that that Men Engage believes in, and part of our reason for having our activists and men engaged in this work today is to share much more explicitly what they believe in and how those personal beliefs inform the professional work that is done around this area. Next slide. So what Men Engage is not, we're an alliance. So we're not a non-governmental organization. We're a group of organizations coming together to move a field forward. It's not a one-off project or intervention, although we have certain initiatives that we have taken leadership on. We're not based on individuals, but organizations and organizational commitment, and we're inviting groups here to be a part of that and to bring your organizations as a part of our common movement. Certainly not a competitor to women's rights organizations or a competitor to other alliances. And in many cases where we work in countries, we simply have been able to help mobilize within existing networks. Okay? So finally, just a few things about the work that Men Engage is committed to. A lot of work around advocacy and policy, engaging donors in large-scale donor meetings to talk about the work, to share the evidence base of work with men and boys, building leadership networks, both at a global level, but also regionally and at country levels, to create an exchange of the field within these groups, and for them to identify certain policy initiatives or certain campaigns to engage upon around the issue of boys and men for gender equality, and as a resource sharing opportunity so that organizations and individuals can network, share materials, share strategies, and share best practices between each other. So with that, I want to pass it on to the much more interesting part of this session, is to hear a sense of what this work really looks like from key leaders, key people within this field. And so to do that, we're going to have a bit of a talk show. As I said, it's late, and so some of you might be watching television right now. And so instead of watching TV, we'll have our own TV host, Benno de Keyser, who will lead a bit of a dialogue with three gender activists. So I'd like to introduce Benno, and then he will introduce our panel. Benno de Keyser is a professor at the University of Jalapa and also the founder of Salud y Género in Mexico. So, Benno, thank you.
Buenas tardes. Good evening. One of the founders of Salud y Género, please. That's a quite delicate question. Well, we have three persons from three continents, three countries, India, South Africa, and Mexico, drawing from different experiences, different ages also, and we will have a dialogue with them. Please come in and out when you, as you like. And instead of presenting them myself, the question is, who are you and how did you get involved with men? ¿Quiénes son ustedes y cómo se involucraron en un trabajo con hombres? Algo tan extraño en este inicio de siglo. Please.
Hola, ¿sí me escucho? Yo soy Raúl Morales, voy a hablar en español. Soy de México.
In Salud y Género for 6 years, working with young men in the topic of masculinity, with young women, and about empowerment. And last year, I coordinated the H program in Mexico, and I've been working with a Salud y Género colleague, female colleague, working in the program on what it is to raise awareness amongst young men and women, the topic of sexual diversity and the homophobia topic most especially. And I'll tell you whence this idea of working on homophobia with men comes from. Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Well, my name is Ravi Verma, and I work with the International Center for Research on Women. How did I get involved into this field? That's what your question is. Well, my background is in research, and I got involved working with men from a very research perspective, really, not from the perspective of moving a gender equality movement further. But over the period of about 8 years of working primarily from HIV prevention perspective, I transformed. In fact, there has been a transformation happening in my own conceptual and the manner I started looking at the issues on the ground and started constructing the research designs and issues on who should be involved and how should that be involvement be done has been a process of my own shift. But then I began as primarily from research framework, and now I'm on gender equity movement part of this entire process.
Good evening. My name is Bafana Khumalo from South Africa. I got involved with this work through my own involvement and journey in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. In the heat of our struggle in the early 80s, the major focus was on us getting political liberation. One of the contradictions that I began to see as I was a student then studying theology was how even within the liberation movement, there was a hierarchy of what was seen as priority needs for transformation. And the first priority was transformation with regards to political change in our country. And in that process, the equality of men and women was relegated to something that, if I were to use a parlance, a theological parlance, let's get political liberation first, and everything else will be added. And so the women's struggle was relegated to something that we will see after liberation. And for many of us, we began to see this contradiction as something that undermined what we saw as the important hallmark of what we were struggling for and struggling against. Because any discrimination in my book is discrimination that must be treated very seriously. We cannot put hierarchies and say, no, let's get political liberation first, and then we can see what happens to women. And I got involved because of those contradictions within our own circles, because I sensed that transformation has to be holistic, it has to be integrated, it has to be inclusive of all sectors in our society. And this is how I came about into this struggle.
Thank you much, Bafana, Ravi, and Raul. So we have a young activist, we have a researcher, we have a program officer working in very different contexts. And Bafana raises one of the difficult questions in working with men. How does this relate with the work women are doing, with women's movements? Is it carried out in alliance? Is it in parallel? Is it in conflict, in tension with women's movement? Who would like to answer that?
I think I'll start. Okay. For us, it is in partnership with the women's movement. We see this work as collaborative. We see this work as advancing the cause that women have won over years in terms of the feminist movement, which needs to be strengthened, which needs to be consolidated. And so there can be no sense for us, at least as Sonke Gender Justice, to see this in opposition to what is happening, to see this in confrontation. We see this more as collaboration and partnership and building alliances in ensuring that indeed we advance the cause for a human rights framework in our contexts.
Well, in India also, when we began looking at the issue of how do we reduce risk behavior among men and how do we promote HIV prevention in a low-income community, we were aware of the fact that we cannot work with men and boys alone unless this component is built along with the programs on the ground that already address women. So we began working with the partners, in fact, on-the-ground partners that we work with, is Committee of Resource Organization, which is again a loose network of consortium of organizations working within Mumbai low-income communities. They are primarily a women's organization, actually. They've been working in those areas for the last about 16, 17 years, working with the self-help groups and working with women's groups, empowering them in a variety of other ways, working on social and political aspects of empowerment. And there was a clear felt need by this organization to engage with men within the community because they were seeing men as resistant, as barriers to moving their own programs. So there's a clear demand for working with men by this group of organizations when we came on onto the scene. And then we put our heads together to design a study, a very systematic plan to engage men as part of this women's program within the community. But during the phase of experimentation, we kept the men's program independent of the program that was happening already, you know, as part of the program, of the ongoing program. But as I will describe later, if I get an opportunity, the program moved in different phases. So we began with an organization working on women, but we had an exclusive men's component, and later we converged these two programs to see the impact. So we have in our design a particular way of assessing whether if you do a program with women alone or with do men alone or with, when you do men and women together, yep, what is the kind of impact it produces. So that was precisely the kind of research question that we had. But in the process, we started working together, and then the synergies, you know, started evolving. So that's
Raúl.
En México, en salud y género en especial, reconocemos.
In Mexico, we acknowledge that in gender work, women are pioneers. So there is this analysis of gender and masculinity. There was a great deal of work carried out by women in reproductive health, gender and women. And we joined the sentence of women in international conferences that we thought was essential to engage men in the reflections and sexual health and violence so as to improve the sexual and reproductive health of women. And it is thus that health and gender leads us to reflect that it is essential to work with groups of women, women specifically, and men working with men. But in the world, both genders live together, men and women. So we have to develop regional methodologies and health and gender together with the allies of men in health for HIV, and we promote work between men and women in order to achieve better results. Gracias, Raúl. Si no pueden entender a Raúl, hay audífonos, y es importante que se utilicen las dos lenguas. Pregunté sobre el conflicto de alianza, alliance, y trabajar en paralelo hombres y mujeres. Ustedes han hablado sobre alianzas, pero hay diferencias entre trabajar con los hombres en comunidades o hombres que trabajan en relación con organizaciones de mujeres o organizaciones de mujeres que trabajan con hombres. ¿Pueden hablar sobre esta tensión? Porque todo parece muy fácil y que fluye. Bueno.
And understandably so, I think there's, at least in our context, skepticism about work with men, particularly from women's groups. There are lots of arguments that are placed on the table around is this taking resources away from work that women have been doing? Is this another ploy by men to take over the feminist discourse? Is there an agenda to reinforce patriarchy through this back door? And I think for our part, we, as an organization, we felt it's important that we prove our bona fides in the work that we do through the values that we hold and how we live up to those values, so that indeed we can prove to the women's movement our commitment to this, but also to mobilize men about why this is important for men. Because I think working with men in this is not just about how it benefits women, whilst that is important, but it's also about how it benefits men, who in our context live very risky lives, and what I call exemplify dangerous masculinities. And the point is, how does one intervene really in a society so that we do indeed engage men on these matters that will help improve how men look at their own health, their own lifestyles, their own risky behaviors, and that will benefit society broadly in long term. But I think it's something that requires a lot of effort as we are establishing this relationship with the women's movement.
Raúl or Ravi? Any other two?
Nosotros nos cuestionábamos si era el movimiento.
Doubted whether the movement of masculinity would adhere to the feminist movement. I believe that men's movement has to create certain ideologies and certain basis for struggle. There are three points where we coincide. It coincide in the movement of women: violence and gender, reproductive health, and that women involve themselves in the education of children, the upbringing of their children. Bueno, ha sido
experience working in a large community setting in Mumbai, working with men within a women's organization, and then gradually bringing women on board to work on similar issues. And I completely endorse the views expressed by my colleagues here, that it has not been a very easy task. It's an ongoing process, and challenges have been pretty difficult to handle. In fact, there's no one-time solution to this. I remember when we began this whole program about six years back, working with boys alone, and once that entire set was done, the our study was over, and when we started planning for women's groups, this was the same. Many of these same boys resisted their own sisters and their own family members to join this program. You know, in fact, we had the women's community, which were combined with men's community. We had the maximum resistance. It's interesting, because the boys who underwent this entire program, and we thought we have transformed them, many of them felt that this is something which this is for their own personal understanding, gender and sexuality. It does not apply. And it applies as for others, but not within their own families. So that they were really resisting the whole idea of their sisters or their wives to join in this program of bringing them together and working and discussing issues of gender equity and sexuality and issues like this. And our partner organizations had to work extra hard to go back and then do additional home to home work and through their own women's network to make sure that women start coming in. And at the end of the day, we didn't really find very clear-cut difference in these two different communities, really speaking, in terms of, in fact, what we, on the other hand, we found that the women alone community on gender equity programs had shown much greater impact. You know, so now what I'm not saying the program was a failure, but I think this is a constant struggle with when we start combining men and women in an extremely patriarchal, extremely structured society, like I know about India and South Asian societies, which is where this dominant form of masculinity is so ingrained that you only begin questioning them. And in the process of questioning, we have to be extremely careful in combining these two, because more often than not, these men start. Their immediate reaction after getting this tool in their hand is to feel empowered and become more patronizing, you know, in the instance. And therefore, that is an ongoing process that we need to, and we have to be careful. When do we start merging them together, these two programs? I'm not talking about the word movement is something which I don't understand completely, because I am not an activist in the sense that the others are. I see many of these programs on the ground. As they roll out, they have an implications for men and women both. And we have seen it on the first hand, you know, by doing this program on the ground, experience those tensions of different kinds. In fact, within the community, when we had a discussion and campaign on domestic violence, and the campaign was led by this community-based these men and boys, it was registered by both men and women from the communities, because the open discussion on the domestic violence within the community was seen as some kind of a private affair by, and it's taken for granted, as you know, from many large-scale DHS data, and our NFHS data also suggest that a lot of women, about 60% women, justify violence, domestic violence on a variety of reasons. So in order to ensure that their family remains intact, they were not willing to participate in this kind of discourse in the open forum, and there was a resistance to this whole, although those women were still part of this women's program, you know, that was going on. So, yes, it's a mixed kind of required ongoing surveillance on what we are doing and how are we doing, sensitively handling and putting out faces who could address these issues with a lot of sensitivity within the community while working on these issues with both men and women.
So I think it's important to acknowledge that we seek partnership, but yes, there's different problems on the way, both in research, both in activism, and that men work with men still confronts a long and winding road. Looking on another side of the work with men, homophobia, how do your organizations and how do you address and confront homophobia as another axis that constitutes men? Not only misogyny, but also homophobia.
Can
Are
I?
You starting?
Can
yes,
I?
Of course.
Well, homosexuality is a tabooed issue within the Indian context in South Asia, and no one talks about it. And we, in fact, in our study, we didn't really succeed in going too far in deconstructing this whole idea of homophobia with men and definitely not with women. In fact, we had to modify. You may be aware that the program that we are doing is kind of inspired by Program H, which was done in Brazil and has very strong components addressing issues of homosexuality and homophobia. But while adapting, we had to completely give up that whole idea after about 6 months of experimentation, because boys and young men were not prepared to talk and not ready to take it too far in their lives as it relates to others, as it relates to themselves. So it was, I would say that, and on our indicators also, we still see that there has not, that's a very strong point feature of our study, that we clearly show where it has impacted, where it has not impacted. And the issues of homophobia has not been impacted very successfully in India, despite having worked for about 7-8 years in a very focused manner with these men and boys. So I think it is something, this is an issue which would require much greater creativity and much greater engagement, much greater public faces and endorsement, and a lot of normative programs that would address norms rather than working straight on to the individual's behaviors issues. So yeah, that has been a challenge for us.
Para nosotros queda este tema pendiente. Mucho trabajamos con hombres jóvenes el programa H y el tema.
Well, with the H program and the pending assignment is homophobia. Is the experience in Brazil. It is the indicators that didn't change after working with young boys. It was always there. Homophobia was always present, was looming over us. But working with young boys helped us. Made a deeper analysis of the problem of homophobia. We, more than seeing this as a problem of homosexuals and homophobes, homophobia was like a surveillance in the system of socializing masculine gender. There is homophobia among women that are not homosexual and women that are not lesbian. So the gender system has to go back to the mainstream behavior. There are many young people who don't like football, and Mexico is a football society. These children were attacked by the other children who played football. They are not men, and these were homophobic comments in regard to them who did not like football. So there was surveillance on the gender system, and it was even rougher in the socialization of masculine gender. This is a pending task and when working with men, and one of our main efforts is the D program, which is working not exclusively with LGBT population, but with men and women, especially young ones. We work within the context of schools, and it has been very useful. In the H project, we have worked with a video that refers to the homophobic topic, and young people that were able to interject these reflections on homophobia and masculinity, and especially here in Mexico, we have the argo of double meaning, and boys could reflect on how they were surveilling their own schoolmates with homophobic attitudes. But nevertheless, we cannot overlook that homophobia continues to be important for the LGBT community, especially in those cases where violence has been extreme and there have been hate crimes. But this helped us take this problem to the everyday life for the socialization of everybody. In our work with young men, we worked with gay men, and they reflected on the introjected homophobia within the gay society.
A legal framework which is favorable to the gay community in South Africa, gay and lesbian community since 1994, which has created a framework that provides protection. But what we have seen is unprecedented levels of violence and hate crimes against this community. Killings, particularly in black townships, where there is still a lot of denial of the existence of this community. In our own work as Sonke, we include activities in our curriculum that seeks to raise awareness, even in trainings that we do with men on these issues, because we think it's something very important in our context. We also participate in an advocacy campaign that has been set up by the LGBT community called One in Nine, which mobilizes society to take up issues, particularly with the police, security forces, the criminal justice system, but also to look at challenges where the policies that I've spoken about, which are very favorable, are not implemented as well as they should. And it's something that we see as very important as an organization, and we continuously engage through this campaign on manners in which we can improve how we create a favorable climate in our context for a much more safer and open society. It's the tragedy sometimes, I must add, that sometimes some of the homophobic statements are issued by people that are supposed to know better. You know, political leaders, our current president of the ANC issued a very terrible statement about a year ago, almost demeaning to the LGBT community, asserting that in his culture, a gay man cannot stand in front of him. And he was challenged on that. And I think he retracted. Within a space of a few days, he withdrew that statement and apologized unreservedly. But I think whilst he apologized, what he also demonstrated is what I call closet bigots, for lack of a better word, who have, you know, particular views about the LGBT community, but would obviously have the political speak in public, which seems to condone, and yet privately they would hold views that are really dangerous. And the challenge is, how do we really unmask these kinds of views and ensure that we challenge leaders to really take leadership on these issues in our society. And that's a matter that at least we are committed to do as an organization in participating in these advocacy processes with the LGBT community.
Thank you very much. In our context in Mexico, it's common also to hear homophobic comments, even from a minister of health, and the apology next day after press and the whole community is on him, on his back. And the apology is not too believable. Taking a step forward, how does your work address another problem, the situation of people living with HIV, their rights, and do your programs engage with them in some meaningful way? Can you start, Bafana?
Yes, we do. In the work that we're doing, we work with the Treatment Action Campaign, which I believe most of you will be aware of their work. We collaborate in public advocacy processes whenever there are issues that are raised by this community. We also collaborate with the AIDS Consortium in many of our programs, which is an organization that is working in asserting the rights of people living with HIV/AIDS. And we see this as a very important part of our work. In our own endeavors, we also seek to monitor compliance where government has made commitments with regards to provision of services, for instance, treatment and broader services for people living with HIV/AIDS. Where we are able to pick up some of the discrepancies, we collaborate with other partners in ensuring that we raise these issues. We look at issues of policy, where there are gaps, to what extent we could raise our voice as an organization in ensuring that those issues are corrected in terms of policy formulation in our country. So indeed, we do this work, and we do it in collaboration with the people who are living with HIV/AIDS, because we think it's important that we don't do things for people, but we do with, so that indeed their voices also are foregrounded in whatever we do.
Well, in our context, very interesting that HIV provided us the opportunity to work on this issue to begin with. But very soon we realized that we need to work on the structural aspects of behavior change rather than focusing only on HIV. And therefore, our program took a complete paradigm shift and worked on the gender. I think this is one of the few exclusively focused gender, promoting gender equity program, and we don't directly engage with HIV, people living with HIV in the program, but definitely the attitude towards people living with HIV is a part of our educational curriculum and campaign programs. But we engage with men and boys in the community within and trying to promote this gender equity within the right-based framework, and the idea is that they must respect, every human being for whatever, and they should not discriminate or no stigma around these issues because a person is HIV or non-HIV. So, on one hand, we address this issue in a much more broader structural sense, but we don't engage with people living with HIV in any meaningful in our program.
Nosotros básicamente nos quedamos en el trabajo de línea de base.
We stay at the baseline type of work with young people. What happens here is that there's a total lack of information in this regard, so we carry out promotion for HIV prevention. We don't know youths. We haven't worked with youths who live with HIV/AIDS. I have friends, and I know or my own in the state where I live is very conservative, and so I became even more sensitive to the issue of people living with HIV/AIDS and carrying out the prevention work with the youth and doing away with taboos and preconceived ideas and biased ideas, because sometimes they think that they will be infected through saliva by sharing using somebody else's plate, by kissing someone. So it would seem quite far-fetched, but many people have these fears, especially because we work with young people in faraway communities, indigenous communities, and country, rural.
And I want to ask you about a major problem in working on gender issues, and especially with men, when you have to confront traditional gender norms and oppressive gender relationships in different contexts in the three countries. How do you address that in your work?
Well, that's a very important one for us because we still have lots of adherence to cultural and traditional norms. And when you talk gender, usually people dismiss that as a Western notion, which almost closes a discussion. But I personally have found it very useful that one can turn things around. In the context of South Africa, for instance, the core philosophy around African culture is the phenomenon of Ubuntu, Ubuntu Butu. And that phenomenon, I start there, and we work as Sonke, primarily we target traditional leaders. Because we think it's important when you target the leaders who hold these views, you get a buy-in from them. It opens doors for you to also access people in the communities that they are leading. Many of them are not very gender sensitive in many respects. But I think when you begin to engage them, as I say, on something that they hold very dear, they cannot dispute when I describe what Ubuntu is. Ubuntu is about humaneness, it's not gendered. It's about how we define what humanity is. And I begin to build on that. If indeed African culture is about Ubuntu, and that we are all human beings, and that we all have dignity, and we are all people of integrity, why would you then justify treating a woman as lesser than a man? Because then it goes against that cultural edifice. And we then open up the envelope, because once you have won them at that level, you can then move to the next level and begin challenging some of the other issues that people are placing. People will argue, for instance, on gender violence, that it's my culture that as a Zulu, for instance, I must put my wife in her place. And we always go around and say, but Zulu culture says, as a man, you are supposed to protect and not cause harm to your own family. So where does this culture come from that says, to prove your manhood, you must prove by being violent against your own family? So through turning things around like that, I think we are opening up the space for more discussion, for a more thorough critical reflection and engagement with culture. But we also raise the question that, by the way, culture is not rigid. People will always say, this is how my father used to do it. And I always argue, culture is dynamic. And I make a joke, and traditional leaders don't find this very amusing, that even as they speak about culture and how they are custodians, many of them are wearing Italian suits and are using most sophisticated cell phones. Now, for me, that has been an adaptation of what the situation, how far the situation has moved. They are not wearing traditional clothes that they used to wear in the 18th century. They have moved, and therefore culture has adapted. It has changed. And cultures, by their definition, change all the time. Cultures adapt to situations. Cultures evolve. And when you begin to engage with them, they begin to shift and move. It's a very difficult shift, but I think a very significant and important one.
Well, we work on certain theoretical premises when working with men and boys. And one of the first premises is that we see men as partners and not as obstacles. That has been a conventional view that they are. The other premise is that the men out there want to change. They are challenging. There are men who are challenging these norms, but they are not voicing themselves because of the dominant norms against this. So the issue is, how do we support and sustain some of these voices which exist already from the men who are challenging these norms in their own indigenous manners and give them a legitimacy and the space and the platform and help them to get normative support around their voices. So it's kind of our approach. So our one challenge had been to get these men out of their shells who are believing in these equitable norms but have not voiced it properly, appropriately, and give them the space so that they could feel empowered to talk about this. So that has been the kind of our approach. And in that process, our view is that it is leadership, the right kind of leadership, which could be projected as a role model within the community whom people could confront, challenge, you know, throw them around, is what we need. And therefore, the men that we, the first round of our the peers as the facilitators of this entire program or the motivators of the program came from the community. They were conventionally tough guys who had everything which was inequitable in their body language and in their language and the manner they would pass comments or live. But since they were kind of errand boys for this kind of this organization that I'm talking about, we could over a, you know, we could detect some of the voices which are positive and bring them on board, and it was about 1.5 year of very painstaking work of developing this leadership within this community, and this was, and we instituted a very systematic process with them. We said, okay, you, these are the issues, we want you to explore yourself. So they started, we used them, you know, we used the opportunity for letting them collect information and analyze themselves on many of these gender and masculinity issues, and they got surprises, you know, when they were collecting and and as a result, they were detached from their own communities, and they looked at the issues which they had taken for granted for years, and they had believed that that should not be, and they knew that kind of intellectualization of the issues. And that really inculcated a sense of conviction among them to talk about it within the community. And when they went back to the community, delivering these messages in a variety of ways, group education and campaign and confronting within the community, when they were challenged, they could revert back, and they could present themselves as models of change. So I think one of the challenges is to really identify and sustain and support men who are challenging these norms in their own ways and bring them out of the community and put them back as role models and support them in whatever way we can, you know, as part of the program and movement.
Coinciden mucho con algunas de las cosas.
I much agree with what you've said. In Salud en Género, we work with youth and health professionals and development and education. And here we
bet much
for this development and raising questions. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? And to make people think, one of the professionals I was working with, he would say, well, after these reflections and these debates, what are they for? So what's in it for me if I start changing? And so the bet on this is to become more flexible in the gender roles, because our UDP shouldn't be that there are two genders, but the human gender only. But the only difference that exists between a man and woman is this immutable biological reality, but not in regard to our spirit. And the human beings have the opportunity to express their feelings and to be, and that the gender would preclude them, that we would see them as half human possibilities, and this utopian to really bet on human gender. And this will make all these preconceived ideas collapse. Gracias por todas estas aportaciones.
Optimistic in this transition from resistance to change, and expect more Ubuntu in the future. Andrew?
Thank you. I just want to first give an opportunity for the crowd to recognize these three wonderful panelists and Benno for their commitment, professionalism, and activism. I included activism, Ravi, and don't think you're not an activist, even if you say you're not. We all find our different ways to create change, yes? I'm going to give an opportunity for the group to pose some questions to our esteemed panel. But before that, I wanted to give an opportunity to add more context, more nuance, more complexity to the issue. And to do that, I've asked Jerker Edstrom from the Institute for Development Studies to come and share some of his reflections on this issue. Jerker has worked with IDS in really giving an opportunity for leaders in the field to come together and have some analysis around these issues of gender and masculinities, and particularly looking at how structures and issues of politicalization are related to this. So I'd like Jerker to share some comments, and then we will then open it up to all of you at the stands if you'd like to ask some questions of Jerker or other panelists.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Gary. I just need to now find where this... Oh, it's not up there. Hang on.
It is.
Okay, it's coming. Here we go. All right, so also to express my thanks to Banyan and all the panelists for something that reminds me of a quote by one of our participants at a workshop we had in the car last year, that there's this feeling of ascendant possibility against phenomenal odds here. and also reminds me of just the sense of humility that I have about what is possible and what an uphill struggle we have ahead of us. I tried to get Stephen Lewis to come to this session just before, and he was kind of fobbing me off with a joke about, oh, you guys are doomed by nature, and provided me with a kind of essentialist view of masculinity, but he was joking, so I should not, and I do share many of his gender perspectives. So let me talk a little bit about this workshop that we had in Dakar not too long ago, where we invited a group of academics, activists, NGO workers, and policymakers, and I'll try and to some extent related to the earlier discussions, but I think we can do that in questions and answers as well. But when I came to IDS a couple of years ago, I started to engage with Andrea Cornwall, a fairly well-known writer and activist in gender and women's issues, but also on masculinities. And we decided that it was high time to actually start looking at masculinities and gender in new ways. And we thought of how can we do this? It seemed like a good idea to actually bring together some of the best people we knew from around the world on this topic, just in a really nice environment, and have a proper dialogue about the issues. So we came up with this idea of a symposium in Dakar, and basically we tried to get about 50 people together, but we got 41 people from 5 different regions. And basically, we did it in order to consider the current constraints in HIV, gender, and sexual health and rights work with men. Many of us had some frustrations with how far, but how little we've actually done as well. Also, to consider the challenges and limitations in our current theory on gender and masculinities for improving such work. We wanted to hold academics accountable to the fact that we're not actually able to provide activists with very useful tools. We also felt that there were the potentials for engaging a broader range of men and more politically in sexual health and rights and struggles for gender equity, and that we shared as a general kind of ambition. Now, this is the cover of the report that came out of the workshop, which was a barber sign in Dakar outside the workshop. I've left a couple of copies down here, which are still there, so I'd encourage you to pick one up on your way out. But why did we want to look at politicizing masculinities beyond the personal, as we call the report and the meeting? Much of the most innovative work on men and masculinity has worked at the level of the personal, essentially on men's behavior, and particularly in HIV work, because we came into this often funded to do behavior change. But there was a realization amongst many that HIV prevention and sexual reproductive health and rights needs to go beyond individual behavior change. Many of us have obviously realized this for women and anybody else as well, at least a decade back, that individual behavior change is not an easy thing to achieve without actually looking at structural issues. But so on the positive, the HIV epidemic has forced a greater acknowledgement of the fluidity and the diversity of men's sexual and social identities and roles in the epidemic. We didn't really talk about these issues before HIV and AIDS so much. Also, within the gender and development field, if you like, the men as the problem and women as the victims discourse continues to hold sway and still keeps many men away. It's difficult to engage, as we've heard in some cases, to engage men in debates about gender because they feel like they're presented as the problem, and often they are, actually. but we need to find a way to cross that. Also, the current discourse tends to rest on essentialisms, which are rarely brought into question. And many of us felt that those essentialisms are essentially reproduced by our own very theories of gender and as a relational concept between women and men. And so work with men in development has failed to engage with some of the core issues around of power and the need to change institutions that sustain inequitable power relations in gender. So an issue, for example, like male violence is obviously both a personal issue and a structural issue. So we can't actually just focus on personal behavior change. We have to look at the broader context, the social, the cultural, and the economic relations of power. Now, these are some of the participants. I mentioned that we brought together some really exciting and unorthodox academics, some open-minded and reflective practitioners and activists, as well as progressive policymakers from our perspective, which included people who attended the workshop from UNFPA, UNAIDS, Swedish CEDA, and Norway, NORAD. And they were all there and very active, and they also funded, helped to support and make the workshop possible at all. We also had financial support from the Ford Foundation, by the way. Some of the questions that we were looking at in the car were around various issues related to the justifications for the workshop, essentially. There was exciting debates about men's anxieties around the need to conform to gender norms, but also to perform sexually, which actually pose risks to condom use and inhibit men from exploring sexual pleasure or discussing sexual pleasure. These are some issues which we felt are still very looked at, if that makes sense, in HIV programming. And for example, in debates about circumcision, we hear very little about what role foreskin might have in terms of pleasure. We had some related discussions about masturbation, which were some of the best ones, actually, some believe. Is masturbation unfaithfulness? And it's good. And some of that is actually reflected in that report, so I recommend it. Okay, we also discussed questions about the fact that to recognize men and their role in sex and HIV is not to deny the harm that they can actually do to others and indeed to themselves and each other, and particularly also women when I talk about others. How can we actually break away from this binary gender, men and women, without losing track of the fact that we do have structural inequalities between women and men in general, even if they're very, very complex? How do we actually engage with men's realities and vulnerabilities? Because there was a lot of talk about men's vulnerability, and particularly crisis in masculinities when unemployed men, for example, are faced with massive pressures about to prove their masculinities, and so on. How do we engage with all of that without positing men as the new victims, if you like? How can we actually make sure that we bring out the issue of accountability, you know, engage men, and overcome all the tensions that are involved with engaging women and men in debate about gender, but also get us men ourselves to accept, take some accountability for male supremacy and the privilege that comes with patriarchy? How can we actually bridge those quite big chasms in many ways? So finally, there was discussions about heteronormativity as maybe a more interesting and versatile way to look at the issue of gender and masculinities rather than having this kind of binary. We had a difficulty around heteronormativity, which we found useful because it speaks to issues of power and normativity. But we also had some difficulties because it doesn't trip off your tongue very easily. Most people don't understand what it is. I've actually heard it quite a lot at this conference, and I expect it's more used in Latin America, actually, than in Africa or Asia. But how can we make that one more useful and acceptable? It also has this like connotation of being anti-heterosexual, which isn't necessarily very helpful if we are going to engage a broad range of men. So we had discussions around four broad areas. I don't have a slide on this, but we do need to change our language and theory around masculinities and gender. That's a whole set of discussions we had. We need to actually explore male sexuality for itself much more, men's bodies and men's pleasure. We had the idea of creating books, men's bodies for dummies or something. And then thirdly, we do need to look beyond the personal and link this to the structural and the political. How can we engage with that and make sure that doesn't end up in two different camps? And finally, the fact that we do need to mobilize men, which relates mostly to this symposium. How do we actually build a global movement of men and boys? So just on that, we felt that we need to actually reorient and politicize existing work with men, which often takes the shape of workshops and trainings, etc. Not to dismiss that work, that's all very important, but we need to go beyond that. I mean, we felt that we would need things like consciousness raising on structural issues, which also raises issues of self-critical awareness and accountability, of course. We would need to mobilize men to campaign for changes in government policy, in legal justice systems, in corporate practice, etc., in armies, in the police, in various institutions of male power. And we'd need training to, including partnership building and movement functioning, if you like, capacity building for men as activists, in particular men. We need to actually identify and infiltrate men in certain institutions of male power and infiltrate those institutions to actually engage in gender regime change. So then we had some follow-up activities, which included this report that's down there, a policy briefing that's also down there that actually looks at those institutions of male power quite a lot, army and police in particular. There's some follow-up events that we're hoping to do. This is one of them in AWID in Cape Town, Commission for States of Women, and then the Global Symposium in Rio next year. So thank you very much. And just to, again, thank the people who made this possible, which was Swedish SIDA, NORAD, and UNFPA, UNAIDS, Ford Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerker. If you have a burning question, I'm going to ask you to hold it for one moment, or it could be a comment, because we're going to open up to reflections as well. But before doing that, I wanted to just finish out our panelists just so that we would then leave the rest of the time for reflections and comments. So I'm going to ask Gary Barker to come up and share with us just some other updates about Men Engage, some current events and activities that we're doing to create and move this movement along. So I'll ask Gary to share a few reflections, a few things, particularly on an upcoming symposium and a website to share information with you, and then we will open it up for questions and reflections. So if we could have the thirds, actually the web. Yes.
Not yet. I've got a clip. Okay. Wait. Okay. There we go. Can you hold that for a second? Thanks. I think it's clear from what we've heard so far, and I think it's clear from our practice as activists, as researchers, as programmers, as academics working on this field, that challenging patriarchy, challenging heteronormativity, challenging homophobia, challenging men's violence is much more than a group of a few men doing this work and a group of a few women doing this work. We started Men Engage with that recognition that to really drive this work must go beyond the small and the personal to the political, as Jerker has said, With that said, MenEngage is a network, but it is also a movement. It is a movement that is politically motivated. It's ethically motivated. It has room at the table for activists and for researchers and researcher activists and activist researchers and program folks. It is about driving political movements, but it's also evidence-based. We do want to look at what works, what drives change, and understanding that change. We've been working in the last few weeks on coming up with a flag, with something that tries to get succinctly what we're about, and I'd like to show that to you this evening. It's kind of the first showing of it. So now if you could show that clip, this is an attempt to have our movement. This is an attempt to define, anyway, as you open up the MenEngage website in the next month, calling organizations to come on board, to learn from experiences, to share experiences, to sign on board to different advocacy campaigns. This was our attempt to get that out in a few words. We are at the moment about 400 NGOs working in 22 country-level networks across Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and South Asia, networks forming soon in North America and in Europe. And I won't go into a long list because it's been a long day of the things that we're up to, but I'll give you a few ideas of what we're trying to do. We're developing some compiled practice tools together with UNFPA, UNIFEM, and WHO. We're working on implementing the White Ribbon Campaign, Men Acting to Stop Violence Against Women in more than 60 countries worldwide. We're starting country-level advocacy campaigns. This week in Brazil, we launched with the MenEngage National Network in Brazil a campaign to increase paternity leave for men. The campaign is called Give Me Leave, I'm a Father. In Portuguese, it's Dá Licença, Sou Pai. And it plays on the kind of the double meaning of give me paternity leave and also kind of step out of the way or help me because I'm caring for the next generation. It was launched with a clip this week in Brazil with four television actors. It is dialoguing with the Secretary General in his campaign of the UN, of his campaign of ending violence against women, of trying to identify men who can be activists as well, putting their voice toward this. It is discussions with ECPAT, the global network of ending child trafficking and prostitution, that has its Third World Congress coming up in November. More than 5,000 delegates from around the world. It is helping them think about how men can be involved in repudiating the violence that is behind sexual trafficking, pedophilia, and violence. It is working with Sankar Gender Justice and Family Violence Prevention Fund to have discussions with FIFA about the World Cup 2010, figuring out how we might take advantage of how many men's eyes and women's eyes will be watching football players next year in South Africa, or rather 2010 in South Africa, figuring out ways we can include messages about gender-based violence and about HIV. And that's only a part of the list at the moment. There is more to come. It's also about organizing an event this coming March in Rio, a global symposium on engaging men and boys in gender equality. And I think there's a control here. It's up there. It is a deliberately postmodern-looking logo to express how amorphous, how changing, how transitional these definitions of manhood are, and not to have exactly clear what it does mean to be a man. So that was what we asked the artist to do with the logo here. Many of you, we hope, will be wearing this on your sleeve, on a t-shirt, and on a badge as you circulate in Rio de Janeiro in March. There are three overarching themes to this. One, the issue of men and violence. including violence between men, but also men's violence against women, men's health, men's participation in improving the lives of women and children, but also their own health issues, and men caregiving and fatherhood, including caregiving HIV/AIDS, and men's contributions to the care economy. And the overarching theme is trying to take these issues to scale, embedding them into public policy. We're making a concerted effort to get policymakers there, the Brazilian federal government, represented here by a colleague from the Secretariat for Women's Policy, is already an official member of this. The minister, Nilce Afredi, will be there at the opening event and is very much behind connecting this up to women's policy and women's rights in Brazil. You don't need to read all those long names, but it's UN agencies, it's the Men Engaged Network, a number of organizations represented here are putting this together. I won't go into the details, but just to say that as a benefit, you'll be in a hotel overlooking the beach in Leblon. The Global Village will be looking over the Leblon beach. If you happen to try to escape and not participate in the events, we'll be able to watch you and see you, so you'll want to stay and continue to collaborate. We'll have lots of youth participation. We'll have a lot of practice exchange. We'll also be working on a photo exhibition of photos of men in caregiving roles from around the world. And we'll be working together on a collective call to action, building on UN pronouncements that are already there. I'm not going to go too much through the format. We're also going to be presenting data from a global comparative study called the Men and Gender Equality Policy Project, co-coordinated by Promundo and the International Center for Research on Women, that is starting off with a 7-country household survey of the world on men's behaviors and attitudes toward gender policy, toward gender-based violence, health issues, work-life balance, caregiving, partly based on a survey that looked at gender equality and quality of life, to get a sense around the world of are men changing? Can we have a benchmark to get a sense of how men's behaviors and women's behaviors, there's also a questionnaire applied to women as part of this, we'll have data to share as part of trying to drive public policy and drive more of a global reflection, particularly around the structural issues that Jurker mentioned, of understanding what drives change, what's it, also gets in the way of it. There's a few images of some of the photos that are part of the growing number of images that will be presented as well. And I'll just start on the note to say stay tuned. The abstract process starts September 15th. You'll be able to find out about it on the website, www.engagingmen2009, and also on the Men Engage website. Registration also starts September 15th. We hope to see you there. We hope those of you from the Northern Hemisphere won't find it that painful to come to Brazil in the middle of summer, and look forward to seeing you there. Thanks.
Thank you, Gary. So now, as promised, I'd like to open up the microphones to anyone who would like to pose a question to any of our esteemed panelists or to offer a reflection. I know that a lot of times at this conference, people haven't wanted people to share, you know, their particular point of view and simply ask a question, but that's not the case here. So if anyone would like to share something, please feel free to approach the microphone. Yes, or we can move the microphone to you if you like. I'm not sure.
Hello. Hi, Deborah Pelto from Columbia University. I want to thank you all. This has been marvelously inspiring and seducing. I've been working on a project which actually I partially designed using material from the website with Men as Partners. And in the past year, we've done a series of 5 sessions with Latino men in the South Bronx, many men who, all immigrants, many previously incarcerated. And it's been a just terrific experience. Pardon me. And I thank you very much.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Karen. Does somebody need to respond to that?
No, thank you. I mean, I would say thank you. And I'd love to talk to you more about the work in the South Bronx, so thank you.
I'm Karen Hardy from Population Action International, and a huge fan of you guys' work, so fabulous. I was really interested in hearing what you're saying about looking at policy and looking at structural changes. And I just thought it would be interesting to ask the three early panelists, how do you think, given the work that you've been doing in your countries, how easy do you think it will be to have to sort of enact policy change and enact structural changes based on the work you've been doing? Thank you.
Shall we take, you want to take a few more questions? Sure. So we'll take a few more questions and then we'll go on. To the back.
Yeah, okay. This is, sorry. My name is Jennifer Boucher. I'm from Stop AIDS Now in the Netherlands. And I have a question for Jerker. I was really happy to see you here, actually, because I've been missing that kind of dialogue in this Engaging Men work. So thank you very much. A really simple and specific question. What kind of discussion was there at the symposium on hierarchy? Because a lot of feminist writing has addressed the links between patriarchy and hierarchy. And I'm curious what connections were made in this discussion you had in Dakar. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And then we had someone. Do you want to go first, and then we'll take. Sorry.
Hi, my name is Josie, and I'm curious. Your name fell again, so I don't remember your name. But you had talked about utopia, and one question that I've been thinking about is, you know, what is that? What is the ideal that we're going for? You know, what would the ideal masculinity be, or is the concept and construct of masculinity useful at all, and femininity? You know, and also just with, not necessarily as a critique, but as an observation of the Men Engage introduction, it said that, you know, you want to have men be non-homophobic and non-violent, but what are the pro words that we can use, you know? And it seems like tolerance and acceptance are sort of insufficient to reflect what we're going for. So is there a new word that needs to be created? You know, pro all sexuality or something. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Perhaps one final one, and then we'll take it to the panel, please.
Buenas tardes. Voy a hacerlo en español. Soy Johnny Jiménez de Nicaragua. Yo trabajo en
Nicaragua. I work in the Association America of Men Against Violence, an association that has been working for a great many years, similar to the work of the different panelists. In regard to HIV, I want to say that to us it is important to establish a relationship between machismo behavior and our behavior against women. In Nicaragua, the last study shows that the prevailing group in Nicaragua is the women who are homemakers and who receive the virus in their own homes. So we're carrying out a campaign in Nicaragua on this topic, because when we arrive in the communities and carry out prevention work with men, men are familiar with the discourse. They know how to prevent HIV. There's prevention because we have carried out prevention campaigns, but when you have to wear the condom, things that are different. They know that condom prevents HIV, and they don't wear it. That's why we developed a campaign called Condoms Protect. If you don't wear it, you are being violent. On the other hand, I would like to hear from you. An answer to this, in Nicaragua, a new mandate from the cooperation agency is to force feminine organizations to work with men, feminine organizations that have been working for years in Nicaragua, and they are being threatened that financial resources will be taken away if they don't work with men. So I would like to hear what your proposal might be. And on the other hand, I would like to be familiar with your thoughts of the trends of men organizing themselves against feminine women. A national journal in Nicaragua dedicated a whole section of the newspaper to a group of men in Sevilla, Spain, organizing against feminism, against women. I would like to listen, to hear your opinion in this regard. And we, as Association of Men Against Violence, we want to openly request being part of the network you are referring to. Muy bien, gracias.
For wonderful reflections and questions. So I'd like to just ask whoever on the panel would like to respond to any of the four that were posed.
Yo puedo empezar en español.
In Spanish. Bueno,
discuss hierarchy in Dakar. Very much so. Connell was there, and certainly long discussions around the hierarchical structure of multiple masculinities and power relations within that, and also how these are complex and dynamic and changing, and just difficult discussions about how that then relates to relations between the masculine and the feminine along that chain and that those intersections, if you like. So yeah, those discussions were very much there. I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but yes. Just a very quick one on the ideal masculine. What would we ideally want to be looking for? I think the answer to the former question, that masculinities are very multiple and complex, so I'm not sure we should be given a prescription, but my personal one would be something like balanced multidimensional light beings or something.
We've had quite a few sessions and discussions at different regional Men Engage meetings precisely about that. What is an ideal that we're moving toward? Partly we confirm that it's sometimes easier to say what we're not moving toward and what we don't want than necessarily to figure out what it is necessarily about. And I think that's okay at a moment, at this moment in time, to figure out what is it that it's moving toward. It is definitely moving toward greater equality and greater rights. It is trying to make visible those power inequalities at all levels and how they affect men, women, and boys and girls. So I think we thought if we went much beyond that, we were ignoring just how plural this will be and how many voices must be included to talk about what this ideal will be, that anything beyond that sounded prescriptive and sounded like we as a few groups of NGOs were trying to tell the rest of the world what to do. I think perhaps the logo of the symposium was our attempt to show something that was kind of amorphous and unknown where it was perhaps going, but that it was under construction. And I think one of the things that I would say just in terms of Men Engage is that we'd like to envision that in some years it would simply be redundant. It would be a network that these issues are taken up. They're not something that I want to see as fads, and I think that goes to Jimmy's comment. This is not something to say we've got to add gender equality and check it off on all of our boxes, and that means add a few men, add a discussion about masculinities. It does require being reflective about gender's relational, about questioning hierarchies and power. And I think that, and to sort of live with the complexity that that will mean over the next number of years.
Well, I would like to respond to the issue raised on how do we impact policies for structural changes in our respective countries, and I think that is a very important issue for us. And we are addressing this in a variety of ways. One is that although this entire program began as a research program, we soon realized that it has to synergize with the real activists on the ground, and therefore there is a synergy that we started working towards, working with the organizations who are working on these issues as gender activists. So a kind of a movement, we as our partners who are working on this large program became part of this larger movement that's happening as part of many other smaller movements within the country on gender and voicing. So whenever there is a dialogue between policymakers and these activist organizations, we provide a lot of substantive information and the partners work together. So it's the pressure that we bring in from outside the system, working through the large network of organizations, very proactively working with the organizations. That's one, at one level. The another level of impacting on policy had been to directly engage with the policymakers, and we have started working in school system, because we think that if we need to institutionalize these gender notions and gender equity ideas for a longer term impact, we need to work with the younger age group, and it has to be within the school system, and it has to get into the curriculum at different levels, for the teacher's curriculum training, the school, the student's curriculum. And we are working, so we began with dialogues with the three different municipal bodies in India, large municipalities in Mumbai and Rajasthan and Goa, and we brought them on board by sharing these findings with the youths in the community that, look, this works, and there is nothing that we are going to damage your, in terms of sexuality and gender notions, but will produce positive results. And they have allowed to, to work with the students of 6th, 7th, and 8th standards and grades within the public school system, where we are working on adapting many of these modules to the sensitivities of that age group, and again working on inculcating and integrating these modules within the school curriculum system. So I think and at the end of the 3 years, we would like to demonstrate that this could get into the mainstream system, could be evaluated and be shown that, yes, it makes a difference. And that's our endeavor, is to constantly generate evidence as we go along influencing policy and throw it back to the policymakers and, look, this, use it, this works.
The two questions from our colleague from Nicaragua. Indeed, in South Africa, we do have men who are mobilizing against what we're seeking to do, who mobilize men with the view to say, let's protect men's interests, that what gender equality seeks to do is erode what the world as they understood it. And there's been attempts, I mean, by some of these groupings to set up organizations to try and roll back some of these advances. I think our response has been to engage them publicly and continuously show the fallacy of that approach to what the gender transformation agenda is about in our country. And I think when you begin to engage, many of those individuals, will recede and take a back seat on these matters. But we think it's important that they come out openly and can speak about this, because when these things come out in the open, you are then able to deal with them in a much more constructive engagement, in a dialogue sense. And I think the second issue that you have raised, I find very problematic that, you are saying, I'm not sure whether it's your government that says we will not support work that is just done for women if it's not including men. I think it works against what we are trying to do, because it really creates this polarization where it's really now about struggle for resources, it's about fight, who gets the money. I think it puts women against men, which, in my view, undermines broadly what we are seeking to achieve. And I think that approach has got lots of limitations. We obviously, in our context, seek to find ways of how, in the work that we do, even as an organization, how do we collaborate with women's organizations on the work that we are doing, so that it's not seen as oppositional, as I've said, but it's seen as more, how can we collaborate? In some of our programs, for instance, we work with women's organizations and ensure in some of the funding that we are jointly funded to do the work that we are doing. We have several examples of this kind of collaboration.
I'd
like to answer the questions from the colleague of Nicaragua. We always found men that had interjected the problem of gender, how to use a condom, but we saw that there were problems underlying. They were appropriating the sexuality of men. Have you asked yourselves what happens with your sexuality? Because very often a man never doubts about his sexuality, because it's supposed that men are always ready for sex, and we know everything about it. And when men reflect about it, this is not so. So the result was very positive. And I wanted to reflect upon this, because we work at an individual level. I shared a while ago that in health and gender, we see that one of the priorities should be included,
was to include, and that the reflections should go both ways, for men and women, from the individual to the relational. Both genders are continually tied and related. I don't know our Nicaragua colleagues who ask for explicitly direct work with men. I say, okay, we have to work both with men and women. And how are the genders affecting each other? And how? And health-wise, sex-wise, reproduction-wise, and all these actions have to go along with social campaigns. These campaigns always seek to improve or to start creating and fostering cultural changes. If we only work relationally or individually, our work will stay there in an occasion or one-on-one. We saw that working with the young men who joined the AGE program and who were able to come up with reflections. Many of the changes were stopped because the context was not supporting these changes, like in Brazil, a campaign that would support the changes. And for these social changes, obviously, we need to join forces, not only the work of my own organization or the organizations throughout my state. The example of Men Engage is wonderful for us to have a more structural change. We need to all join forces and organize, become organized, because we, here in Mexico, we have the Providas and Mexico and many conservative organizations that will oppose us, especially those who are promoting some feminist viewpoints, because we're destructuring the state. We are questioning the structure of the government of the state, but we have managed to have political changes, structural changes. So I will support this utopia I was mentioning to come up with a public policy. It has to do with the historical and cultural background and to prepare the context in Mexico, the experiences we've had with the lesbian and gay movement in the coexistence movement is to have a political change for it to be approved and the learning curves that we draw from it. So to prepare the terrain of a public policy to just raise the bar and then go to the next one. And we're talking about the social level. We have to make a humongous effort. This is why we have to do network. And this is why Men Engage is here. Maybe there will be other networks to support these our endeavors, but here we have a good example. Well, I'm participating. I want to say that there are policies that they're changing, how they're changing, how far they're changing. I participate in the health sector. In the case of Mexico, I work with seven other countries. Now, there's many issues to begin with. The women in the health sector are not even being seen as integrated beings. And men should also come up with a gender viewpoint. There is still a maternal and child. A woman is a reproduction machine. And Gary was saying that there is a program for men in health in Brazil, directed by a urologist, and the only thing a urologist can think about men and prostate, as if there weren't enough problems and more problems than that. And in the health sector, the attention, if we go over the structure from the Ministry of Health in Mexico, there's a department that looks after accidents, the other with the HIV, the other with reproductive health, the other department with violence, the other one addictions. So everything is fragmented. It's pulverized, and very few people can see that a man or a woman in a determined, in a certain violent situation, maybe his partner or her partner has an addiction issue, an addiction problem, so that puts her at risk of having a non-desired pregnancy, but also violence, risk of violence. So this is a big challenge. And even that way, there are changes in the health sector in Mexico is trying to incorporate the discourse and then landing some programs and have these programs go through the health workers and to and to make some progress in the health sector. In the health sector, they're talking about drug use, about violence. They're creating specific programs for young men and women and for adults, men and women, and at the Social Security and the Ministry of Health. So there's progress that's being made. It's permeating already, but it's still finding resistance and reticence.
From the group, like to ask another question, please. Just come up to the. We'll take one more round and then we'll close. So
we have Toko.
Hi. thank you very much for the wonderful presentations. Having come from the sector myself, you know, I appreciate the work that you do and how difficult it gets. I just wanted to ask. It's actually, I don't know if it's a question or reflections, but I just attended a session which actually just killed me on rape in the DRC and in conflict countries, and how the UN has failed has failed the women in those situations. And in looking forward, you know, I would love to see the men engage and men like that working at such a high level. I know you now like even struggling to work with policies in the government, but at the same time, to hold, you know, because the soldiers go free, the leaders who have committed these acts, the women are being bargained, you know, with their lives, that sort of thing. But at the same time, I also wanted to ask you another question. Having worked in the sector myself as a woman, within gender health, the Men as Partners program, how do you? I always found myself alienated, you know. I came in to tell, because I find that the work is more important to engage the men from a woman's perspective as well, you know. Like, I would tell the men about my story of rape and how, you know, and everything. And yes, I got some sympathy, and I got even positive response where men would call me and be like, you know what, hearing your story, I will never rape again. I will never even do a what, you know, or I will teach my children or my sons not to go that route. But at the same time, I could never find, I found myself alienated because that was my role. But even if I wanted to do meaningful work, you know, but for instance, in South Africa, I would want to talk about circumcision and how it affects men and HIV, you know. And men would be like, we're not going to listen to women. But even though I want to work in this work, how do you think about those things? Just a reflection or something. Thank you.
Go to the back and then back to the front. So the back mic, please.
Yes. I would like to just share one experience from the World Alliance for Breastfeeding Action. This is a worldwide network working on breastfeeding and infant nutrition. 3 years ago, we had a declaration that's called the right of the fathers to participate in the care of the children. And declaration has been translated into several languages and has been endorsed by many, many groups. This is a movement that is growing. This could be very interesting to put these two movements in contact with the engaging men. This could be very interesting. Another thing that I am working with in Chiapas, in the south of Mexico, which is the southernmost part of Mexico, is the problem of suicide among young indigenous people, especially boys. This problem is increasing in many regions in the world, and it is a problem of identity that also should be tackled from the perspective of the gender. This problem, I know that this is happening in India, in South Africa, in many other parts of the world, and it is very related to the problem of identity in young boys that are posted in different situation, and I think this problem should be adopted also and to be analyzed from a gender perspective. I would like to know if this may engaging men is also starting to work in this issue. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Cynthia Totten, and I work at an organization called Stop Prisoner Rape. We're based in the U.S. and we do a lot of work there, but we also do a lot of work in South Africa, and I've been thinking a lot about these issues in the specific context of prisoner rape. which in many ways feels like it is the extreme of the type of the sort of factors and essence of what we're talking about in terms of masculinity and power and just, you know, overabundance of testosterone and people feeling like, you know, they need to control other people. And so I've been thinking about a few sort of, I guess, observations or just thoughts. And so one, I think, is that part of why I had not thought a lot about this before sort of coming to this panel. And I think one of the things that makes it difficult is that getting men involved in sort of fighting gender-based violence is going to require really helping them to sort of disinvest from their own interest in that type of power, whether that means controlling women or controlling men that in many ways they may have deemed as being women in the particular situation that they're in. And certainly that's the case in the issue of prisoner rape, where you have, for example, in South Africa, literally men who are deemed as what are called wifeys or wives, and sort of put into the role of women. And then it's seen as being justified and really not a problem for those inmates to be forced to engage in sexual acts as well as acts like housekeeping and other sort of things that they're told to do by more powerful prisoners. So I think that part of the problem is, I mean, in many ways, prisoner rape is seen as a joke. It's still something that people make jokes about on TV and in the community. And I think that part of the challenge is that maybe men have sort of a discomfort acknowledging the fact that men can be victimized. And I think part of doing this work takes not only sort of confronting men to push themselves further, but it takes confronting them to see that they can be victimized, that victimization of men is horrible and is not more or less than victimization of women, but that it needs to be dealt with just as seriously. And also that there's nothing wrong with essentially crying or needing to heal or speaking about what has happened to you, and that you don't have to be somehow deemed a less powerful sort of man to be able to be a spokesperson for that sort of violence, that even if you're not gay or small or, you know, seen as somehow being relegated to categories of men that would be more likely to be victimized, that it's still legitimate. And I think it also takes recognizing, kind of along the lines of what the woman was saying a few minutes ago who went to the panel earlier today on violence and conflict situations, that the sexual victimization of women, that it causes rage and not just pain. And I think that when men start to recognize that rage, because it's like an emotion or a feeling that they can connect with, and when they start to recognize that women feel that just as much as any man would in that situation, that maybe also can be part of that recognition that this is something that they need to take seriously. And also that men need to, or I guess as part of this conversation, we need to talk about the fact that male sexuality is not something that is outside of their control, that it doesn't make, that violence is not justified by the fact that you say, I can't control my need to do this. And in the prisoner rape context, that's constantly invoked as, I wanted to do this, and so I made a plan, and I was going to do it, and that was how it was, and it didn't really matter. And then the person who's a victim becomes an object, and they're no longer a person, whether they're, you know, man or woman, or in this case, man who's been deemed to be a woman. The last thing that I wanted to say is just that I think the other piece about all of this that's important is that it's wonderful that it looks like this conversation so far is very global and that people from all over the world are involved. But we need to make sure also that marginalized communities within each of these countries are also at the table. So whether that's men of color or poor men, we need to make sure that they too are represented, because otherwise we're not really going to, you know, sort of do away with this sort of gender-based violence.
Great. Thank you very much. We'll hear from the last two questions, and then we'll go to the panel. Three. Supreme, you may go, and Supreme, Lucy, and then the final.
Greetings to everybody. My name is Supreme. I'm actually working with the Men as Partners program, an employee of Engender Health, and I'm glad to have my organization to be part of this great initiative, and I believe that this sort of alliance is going to reach a lot of men out there and help engage men in some of these issues. I'd just like to make a comment to say that as a young man, sort of growing up in a patriarchal society myself, I've observed how sort of the fruits of this society that we have built, and I think it's about time that we all sort of recognize the type of world that we have created. We have a world with so much war, we have a world with poverty that is created by an unfair distribution of wealth and greed, and we have, you know, abuse of different groups of children, of women, of other men, you know, and I believe that, you know, in everything that you do, if this system really worked, we had to see good fruits for everybody, and we're not seeing that at the moment. Even for men, we see that this doesn't work for men. Men are actually dying in war. Men are fighting each other. They cannot cry. They cannot express their emotions. So I believe that in creating this alternative society for the future, there's going to be a lot of benefits for both men and women, old and young people in society. So also, I'm glad that Mr. Khumalo mentioned the concept of Ubuntu, which actually originally meant Ubunkulunkulu Kumuntu, which means the true form of godliness within man, and true godliness is love. And if we all actually do express love for ourselves and the next person, we would behave in ways that wouldn't harm us or the next person. So I'd just like to say this is great, and I love the logo of the upcoming conference, and to the leadership of this initiative, keep it up, and yeah, we are supporting you. Thank you.
Thank you. Two brief questions, so we have enough time for the panel to respond.
Okay.
Lucy, and then the next.
My name is Lucy Atkin. This has been a very exciting panel, very invigorating. I don't want to be a wet blanket by any means. I'm trying to want to make my comment short, but there were a few sort of pieces of comments throughout the panel that sort of are concerning me. Maybe it's the amorphous image on the logo, which is fabulous, but the idea that when I talk about this movement or this work to people, since I've been involved in it for a while, I get a lot of questions like, what kind of man are you wanting? Or what are you working towards? Or what is this going to look like? And then I, as an evaluator, would say, okay, what does success look like? I would ask the group. And so today I heard some comments of, well, sometimes some of the findings showed that the men were just learning the discourse, and it was still going to be imposing patriarchy, but with nicer words, or, you know, and we heard this both at a practical level and some of the theory. There was one little datum that Ravi said something in some study that the women's group village worked out better than the one that also worked with men. So all these little pieces just keep me asking, and I would ask you guys to, and all of us, to spend the time to try to think about what are we going to measure, or what are we going to, how are we going to know we're being successful, and that it's not just creating, you know, some sort of superficial changes, and how do we know what success looks like at both a program level, a project level, and then as, you know, the movement level. And obviously I'm just asking for us to keep talking about that. And, you know, I think we know some of the general parameters. I mean, we obviously want men to rape women less, or not at all, or be less violent. So, I mean, there's some of the negatives that we want to eliminate, but sort of what does it really look like when we get there? I think we need to keep that conversation going.
Thank you.
Hola, voy a hablar en español. Soy Alexis.
I am Alexis Hernandez from Mexico, and will try to make you know a concern I have. I work in a project of educational intervention for the uniformed personnel in charge of public security and peacekeeping in the Secretariat for Public Security. security in the federal district. One of the two of the main objectives of our program is to make the population of the Secretariat for Public Security and show its vulnerability when acquiring HIV or being infected with HIV. And another aspect is that they become agents of change in response to the HIV epidemic. But it is this population who are the most violent, and in the Mexican context, one of the components that characterizes violence have to do with sexual aspects that very often hinder the prevention measures in regard to the strategies of exchange of syringes, and they carry out violence against women and girls. So I am before an enormous challenge when I try to craft a friendly focus that will make visible this population as a population which is very vulnerable vis-a-vis HIV. They can be agents of change, and at the same time, they have to show that they are violent. And I would like to ask your opinion in this regard, how to bridge these three components without giving privileges to one of the aspects in order to have a more friendly and more integral approach. Bueno.
On to any of the six comments or questions.
Before I forget, so should I just pick up and...
And I'll ask the panel to be brief in the interest of letting everyone out here more or less on time.
Well, because the issue of, those disconcerting findings, in my view, any program, any serious program that aims at bringing about bigger changes, the key feature that should characterize these programs is in its ability to recognize and sense some of these disconcerting findings or results as you go along, and be able to respond to them as part of our response to the cohesive goal that we want. So I think, and that's why I think evidence building is so key, is such a key element of for us to constantly look at some of these departures from our hypothesized model, and then bring back the response appropriately into the... So, for example, this women's community responding differently from a community which had men and women both gave us a lot of ideas as to how to respond to this. Or if men were resisting their women folks to come into the program, and our ability to sense it and respond to that was based on the fact that we had built in these element as part of the larger program. So I think these are the ongoing issues. That there's never ever, if we see those findings as the end product, then we are failing ourselves. But if we see them as process of evolution and be able to respond to them, I think we will make a larger long-term impact. And I think that's what we were trying and we are trying to do in our programs.
Good. Roll.
I'll try to build a bridge with a topic of violence that came up. And this made me think, as a psychologist, when we work on health, the topic of violence, we come up with the idea that it is not only men that are violent, there are women that are also violent. And most of the population practicing violence is men. We work with many men on the topic of violence. violence been, is working with men giving up their violence. Maybe the reflection of the exercise of violence in men is a matter of power. And in a fine-tuned analysis, we see that the exercise of violence has to do with power. This structure of masculine power leads them to practice this violence. But there are women who are violent following the same scheme of a personal of power, making the other person a subject instead of being a person. This is very very human attitude. And then we go into gender violence. And Alexis, the population you were referring to, is it personal of public health? No, of public security. It's the police. Well, I didn't understand it.
Comendo.
Taking up. Mi estuche de anteojos. No lo ves.
Alexis. Hola, ¿qué te metieron?
In trouble, huh? Yes. And you want, they want you to do this in 6 months and with almost no budget. I think that that is the type of aspects we have to debate, a process of training. There is a whole sequence. I'm thinking of our work with police and military. Maybe they should know that they are vulnerable vis-a-vis the HIV. They should recognize that there are risk encounters in those that are incarcerated, that they recognize that they practice violence, that they can bring this to a personal change. It would take longer time, and for them to be agents of change would be a 20-year project with a heavy investment. We have to examine experiences in Central America. There's an UNFA project that works everything having to do with the sexual health and reproduction. And one of the aspects is to touch on the sexuality of the military. There have been several efforts with more or less limited results, but for them to become agents at does change, they should at least stop being as toxic as they are, and this might be almost an immediate goal. And this is my personal opinion. Now, Alexis, you have given me some ideas. Well, in the first place, it's quite courageous. This is very courageous. This population is very difficult. If it's the military or the police corps, represent a law that has to keep the order of the state within the state. So these topics of masculinity leads them to question the structure of the state, and they question their own identity as a police corps and military. So you would have to develop a sensitive strategy in order to bring about these changes, and policemen could enforce this law in an equitable and fair way. That is what I would expect from them as a citizen.
Comment on Lucy's question of what are we working toward and how would we know that we've achieved it. I think that is one of the key questions to this work. I think it's easy at one level to make a list of some of the obvious indicators. But I don't want to look at those. I'd like to cite two studies that to me suggest the kind of structural gender equality that I think we'd like to move toward. One of them that I'm mindful of is a 20-year study from Norway. 1986, Norwegian government carried out a survey, national household survey, men and women, mostly in heterosexual relationships, asking them about who did what at the household level, how many hours spent doing this, how much they made. 20 years later, tremendous investment in equal pay, paid paternity and maternity leave, that now more than 90% of fathers take the leave, increased balance of time use. And what do we see as a result of that? Families that, or couples that reported greater sharing of the division of work at home, reported greater happiness and better sex lives. One interesting piece of data to talk about. Another study in the U.S. that recently came out comparing gay couples with heterosexual couples. Gay couples showed less conflict
And when conflict was there, more ability to deal with it with humor and without sort of lingering, that is, they were able to get over it sooner than heterosexual couples were. I think that supports perhaps some of the questions about heteronormativity that Yerker was bringing up before. I'd like to say that we can make the easy list of indicators, but let's be creative to talk about what does this big change look like? And on the question of violence, my question would be, you know, as we look at the sexual violence out there, yes, we know a lot about the reasons of why some men use that violence. I think one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, why don't other men who are there as bystanders, who control governments and UN agencies, why don't we say something? Why don't systems permit those of us who don't believe that to speak out against it? And I suppose one indicator for me would be we speak out against it as a group, as men, as women, and that we do something about it.
Okay, I'll make a couple of comments on Toko, I think it was mentioned at the beginning. The other session on the UN failure to deal with the rape issues in the Congo, and it reminded me of another session. I was in this room as well before this one, where one of the presentations was about the Mexican army and being taken to the Supreme Court about throwing soldiers out of the army because of HIV positive status and so on. What I'm trying to get at is that, yes, the points raised are crucial. I mean, the institutions of armies and law courts and police are absolutely crucial for us to tackle in terms of masculinities. We can't shy away from it. I mean, these are the institutions that that maintain the culture of impunity and of male power, so we have to deal with that. But of course, we all realize what an uphill struggle it is. At the same time, change is possible when progressive activists in certain movements, such as the gay movement, get together with lawyers or public health doctors and actually target specific dissident men in those powers, those institutions. So that's really crucial. And armies, because armies play such a big role in shaping young men's sense of gender and sexuality, particularly in countries where national service is the norm, the law courts, of course, because they provide the framework for all this, for any change to happen. And that is certainly a masculinist institution. Police, because police gets lost out a lot in our work. They fall off the agenda. The police are somewhere in between the law and the army, if you like. They police the law, but actually they don't really know the law themselves, usually. So they often police prejudice, and they are the ones that often the first face of contact with authority for sex workers, for gay men, for exactly the people that we need to be working with, exactly those people who need to come at the table, as was asked in the other discussion comment about disinvestment. Yes, we are talking about disinvestment here. We have to be call a spade a spade. We have to realize that there is no such thing as a more gender equitable patriarchal dividend. In fact, I read a paper that suggested that we should come up with more, less harmful way for men to redefine their patriarchal dividend. And I said, no, we can't have a patriarchal dividend that is not bad for women. Come on, let's call a spade a spade. And getting some of those minorities and other groups to the table is crucial in that. That's why we brought people to Dakar who work on sex work issues, for example, as well as MSM issues, because this is about women and men, and the women's issues of sex workers are rarely on the agenda of the feminist movement. But they also had a very interesting perspective on men and men's issues. So unexpected alliances can come about in those settings. So I'll stop there. Yeah, thank you.
Bafana, do you have a last comment? You're okay, in the interest of time. So, in the interest of time, I'm looking and noticing that I failed my chair duties miserably, but I think it speaks to the quality of our panel and of to the issues that were brought on the floor, so thank you very much. I'd like to conclude just by a few announcements. Announcements, Lucy has one, and then I'll make some.
Microphone.
I don't know anything more about it than it is on this paper, but there's a party tonight, which is being sponsored by the Alianza para la Justicia de Género, the Alliance for Gender Justice, and a few other folks. And it's down at a place called El Vicio, which used to be called El Habito, in Coyoacan. It's a very cool place, and it's taking place after this session. So
all right.
Here's a flyer if anybody wants to see it.
Thank you. A very appropriate party for this panel, I would say. A few other announcements.
Especially since we'll need some men to go to the party.
Very well. A couple last minutes. Most of you saw there was a sign-up sheet going around. Please include your information so we can update you about Men Engage. There will be a lot of things coming, including the new revamped website. And just for those of you interested in the regional networks, I would just like to point out a few individuals that you could talk to in terms of the Latin American network. You could talk with Benno. You could talk with Douglas Mendoza. Is Douglas here?
Douglas
was there. Anyway, also Pancho Aguayo from Chile, some other resources.
With the napkin.
Yes. Uh-huh. In Africa, you could talk with Dean Pinkock, Bafana Supreme as well. In Asia, you could talk with Ravi Verma.
There's Douglas Mendoza. He's
and
handing
any
out.
Other regions, please feel free to talk to me and Gary. So with that, I thank everyone for staying a little bit late and for your enthusiasm from this. Oh, and don't forget the IDS publication. There's copies down here and some other resources from our Men Engage partners. So please come take something before you leave. Thank you.